Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast, where top football coaches from around the country share their stories, philosophies, concepts, and strategies to help you get better on and off the field. Now, here's your host, Keith Grabowski.
As you get ready to expand your knowledge this offseason, make sure to save the date for USA Football's 2020 National Conference taking place February 21st through the 23rd in Louisville, Kentucky. This is more than just a clinic. It's your chance to hone your ability to teach proven and effective techniques while connecting with coaches across the country. Most coaches are satisfied if their regional clinic delivers just one or two nuggets of information. National Conference delivers a one-of-a-kind, high school-focused, live field experience that will give you an abundance of drills and techniques to improve your team's performance. Coaches can deep dive into both X's and O's and technique at classroom and chalk talk sessions. Finally, USA Football delivers top keynote speakers year after year. Here's a few of the keynotes from previous years: Mike Tomlin, John Gruden, PJ Fleck, and Jeremy Pruitt. As an added bonus this year, paying attendees can get access to the advanced tackling system and contact system for blocking and defeating blocks following the event, and have a chance to earn the new advanced contact certification. If you're ready to get to work on next season, don't miss out on USA Football's National Conference. Learn more at nationalconference.usafootball.com/podcast. Enter the code PODCAST179 to save at registration. Part two of our NFL coaches and players segment really focuses on guests who have been on the podcast, where the other day we have pulled from some keynote speeches. But these are guys who shared some great things on the podcast, and we give that to you here today. Rocky Seto has had an incredible career as a coach, and he's moved on now to pastoral ministry. But he was a walk-on at USC, worked his way up as a coach all the way to defensive coordinator there, won two national championships in his time at USC, went over to the Seahawks with Pete Carroll, became the assistant head coach, and won a Super Bowl there with Pete. And he talks in this next segment about understanding what defines you. Not what describes you, but what defines you as a person. And this is all very important in being able to prioritize everything in your life, especially in a job as demanding as the coaching profession. Coach, I know one of the things you and I talked about when you were in Indianapolis with our football advisory committee, we started talking a little bit about the importance of work-life balance, and it's something you really believe in. It's a question, as you and I were talking before the interview, that a lot of coaches want to learn more about. They want to find a way to do this more efficiently. They want to find a way to have that balance in their life. It's obviously always going to be a very demanding job. We're not going to eliminate that.
Yeah.
But what's the key to getting that balance between, you know, the job and what is a passion and everything else that you're also passionate about in your life, your family, your faith, your health, all those kinds of things?
Well, I tell you, this is I don't have all the answers, but I'll just share what God has taught me, and it's really helped us, and my family, my wife, and my children. And football is, like I said, is the best game in the universe. Coaching football is such a rewarding profession. Incredible. I mean, if you're an employer and you want to hire somebody, you want to hire a football coach, because football coaches know how to work. Football coaches know how to be about team. Football coaches know how to be dedicated and committed and loyal. Those are football coaches in general. But one of the issues that I've seen growing up in the profession is, where are football coaches with marriages and children? And the reason why I ask this is I like to read books about great coaches. I like to, if I could get a hold of them, talk to them in person. And I've talked to coaches who are probably in their 70s now. You know, they're like a whole generation and a half before me, you know, and meaning in their stage of life, you know, whether it's their marriage or raising kids or their careers. You know, I mean, some of these coaches that I've had a chance to talk to are like Hall of Fame, legendary type coaches that you would recognize, you know. And I just talked to him, hey, talking from an older coach to a younger coach, what would you say to a coach like who's 30 years before you? What would you say? And looking backwards from what you learned, and none of them talked to me about, like, I wish I worked harder, I wish I game planned better, I wish I did this better. And all of them, to a man, almost have said, you know what, Rocky, I wish I did it a little bit differently with my family. I wish I prioritized my marriage and my children, time I spent with my children more. And I'm trying to catch up and make up for lost time with my kids right now. And I'm trying to do it through my grandkids now. And it's good that they come to that realization, but I thought to myself, I don't want to have that same story with my own family. I don't. And what helps is basically realizing this. What is your identity? Okay, just to be clear, what defines who you are? If it's football and coaching, you're going to dedicate all your time and energy to football and coaching. Okay, what I mean by what defines you, what is the ultimate thing in your life? Okay, is it winning games? Is it a career? It's not even just in coaching, but it's in American culture. You know, as men, we're trained to think what we achieve and what we get done in our workplace is what gives us a value. Okay, and just to put it clearly, and that's a lie that we've been living with. And it's important that we work hard. It's important that we pursue excellence at work. But at the end of the day, when I'm visiting people on their deathbeds, it's always comes back to what's the most important thing: the relationship with Jesus Christ. Because in the end, that's all that's going to matter. Secondly, the relationships with family and close friends. That's what matters. Those are the two things that keep coming up are the common thread. Work, how much money, what kind of games they won or lost. Those things don't come up. Those things are not that important. I mean, even the Super Bowl that we won in 2013, you know, it was an incredible blessing and one of the great thrills of my life, but I'm not thinking about that every single day anymore. You know, national championships that we won, back-to-back national championships and Rose Bowls that we won, you know, those are some of the greatest thrills of my life, but I'm not thinking about those things. I'm not wearing those rings thinking about looking how awesome of an accomplishment it was. You know, there are great memories and there are great things that help shape us, but at the end of the day, those aren't what defines us. And for me and my family, what defines us is Jesus Christ. And that he is who gives us value. He's who makes us feel important, valued. And then, so we've come up with a priority, and we call it the priority principle in our family. And in essence, we prioritize what's most important, and we try to stay true to these things. And so as a family and as a couple, we decided Jesus is the most important thing. He is. And secondly is our marriage. And thirdly is raising of our children. And then fourthly is our career, which was coaching football. Now it's pastoral ministry. Even pastoral ministry is fourth on the list. And that doesn't come before my children, how I raise my children, how my marriage, and then how I follow Christ. Here's something that happened. In coaching, here's a kind of a crossover. A principle that I learned from my pastor in California, Pastor Corey Ishida. He told me he did a lot of his work. You know, as a pastor, you do a lot of work with people. And some of the work that you do away from people, like sermon prepping and studying. You do, that's alone time. And he said he did that type of work when in the early mornings or late nights, and when his kids or his wife was available and they needed something, they're available to spend time with. He spent the time with them. And in essence, he sacrificed early mornings or late nights to do those types of sermon prepping things when they weren't available. And that story rung loudly to me, and that's what I did at the Seahawks. I came in early, like sometimes early as 3-4 o'clock in the morning, and got my work done. And in essence, I left as soon as I could. And even the busiest part of the season, you know, the days, Tuesdays and Wednesdays are incredibly busy. I got home around 7 o'clock every day. And I had the blessing of Coach Carroll and the coordinators, Gus Bradley, Dan Quinn, and they let me do it. And if it wasn't for that, I don't think I would have been in coaching the last 7 years, because my children were getting older and I didn't want to miss it. And 7 o'clock is still late, you know, for most parts, but I'm still able to, you know, give them baths when they're young enough. I'm able to go over the Bible with them and I'm able to pray for them. I'm able to have my presence with them. And in essence, you have to, as a coach, coaching is not a conventional thing, meaning, you know, my mom asked me when I first got as a coach, can you earn a living doing that? I said, yeah, you can. And, you know, it's crazy. Yeah, they pay you to do this, and it's incredible. And to coach football for a living, but you have to be creative, just like we want to be creative in our schemes and our teaching principles. We want to be creative in how we teach shoulder tackling. You have to be creative in how you prioritize your family life within coaching. And so at the end of the day, I would say this, the essence is what defines you, what is your identity. Coaching cannot be your identity. Coaching cannot be what defines you. It may describe you. It's just an incredible thing. You know, I'm a football coach. You know, I've coached for the last 18 years. I can say that. It was an incredible part of my past, my history, but it never has defined me. It never could define me. So hopefully that helps a little bit. I know I don't have all the ins and outs of coaching basketball and all that stuff, but or football or baseball, and there's so many things. But that's something that you have to figure out, you know, what defines you and stay true to that priority.
Retired Indianapolis Colt offensive lineman Jack Mehort joined us on the podcast to discuss his experience growing up in the game from his high school career to his playing time for Jim Tressel, Luke Fickell, and Urban Meyer at Ohio State, as well as his time in the NFL. And in this next segment, he discusses what was the most effective for him and as far as what his coaches did in teaching the game. I think this is an important segment for us to understand because we do serve those young athletes, and Jack points out some important things here. Jack, you've sat in a lot of meeting rooms and film rooms and done the off-field work where you're learning the systems, you're learning what you're supposed to do. As you look back, what were the best methods that coaches used to really reach you as a player? And I know everybody's learning style is a little bit different, but what sticks out is like, man, that guy was really good in teaching the game to me in the classroom setting.
It's a great question. I think my best way of learning as a player was visually seeing it, whether it be myself or somebody else doing it on film. I think being able to, if there was an example of it somewhere else, a coach saying, hey, listen, this is what we want here, being able to see that and take that and going out on the field and being able to make the mistakes myself and learn it myself. And the coaches who were, they were hands-on enough to show you and show you the example that you needed, but then go out there and let you make the mistake yourself by trial and error. I think those were the ones that, you know, I really learned the most from. And in that, as far as that classroom setting, the ones that were patient and they didn't just teach out of a binder and you weren't just reading paragraphs describing how to take the steps. You look at the play and then there'd be a coach that would throw it up on the, maybe do the X's and O's on the whiteboard, and then you'd watch it on film. So I think the coaches that were attentive to the fact that there were different people in the room with different styles of learning, you know, some guys it might be verbal. There might be guys who want to see it visually. And there are even coaches who pull you up in the front of the classroom and you'd step through the steps physically. So I think the best coaches I ever had were the ones who were receptive to the fact that guys had different styles of learning and made sure that they hit all those different ways.
Carolina Panthers tight end Chris Manhertz joined us on the podcast. He was a standout basketball player at Canisius College and actually had never played the game until he stepped onto an NFL practice field. And Chris talked to us about the best ways a coach can help his players. Let's take a listen.
You know, I think it's just, especially a player like me coming into this, somebody had to take a chance, right? Somebody had to, you know, see something that was more than what it appeared on the surface. Somebody had to really invest in and believe in you and give you a chance and have patience. You know, that's the biggest thing with me. I'm extremely grateful for the coaches I came across, because at the end of the day, you know, kids and players, you know, work their tail off their whole lives to even be in this position. And to take a player like me who's has never played, much less thought about playing football, is definitely a testament to those who believed in me and had the patience to, you know, plant a seed and watch it grow.
The next part of the podcast really focuses on some of the on-field aspects of this game. And we start with Miami Dolphins strength and conditioning coach Jim Arthur. And he talks about player load and how they work to get their players to top speed during the week, as well as determining what kind of load each of those players can handle.
Well, I actually think there is a lot of carryover, even though there's different level athletes. We kind of deal with the same issues. As the season goes on, there's a fine line because some guys are overtrained, more worn out, and some guys may get undertrained from not doing as much as the year goes on. So as far as them being in shape and energy levels, how they're performing, it's a big thing, I think, at any level to see kind of where they're at without doing too much, they're making sure they're still in shape. So as far as conditioning-wise, I mean, we don't really, especially on the higher level practice days, we wouldn't do any extra conditioning. But the part that we do kind of concerned with is that guys kind of hit close to what their top speeds are at least once a week. Some positions, the guys will go, they may play a whole game, like a DB, for instance, may play a whole game and never hit their top speed one game. And the next game, they may have to, just because of the situation, have to hit top speed all of a sudden. So as far as a conditioning level, making sure that they at least can taste close, doesn't have to be full speed, but close 90, 95% of what their top speed is once or twice a week. With that being said, some guys may do it the whole, have to run more the whole game. Even special teams guys, a lot of times they're running further, so they have to hit the top speed a lot more often than the other positions. So we try to have them kind of taste that level, but with doing that, the volume from that has to be real low. You worry about guys at the end, just their legs wearing out, not having any energy. So doing too much for sure can have a negative effect. We're kind of just choosing the right type of intensity for it.
How do you know, Jimmy? I mean, it sounds like to me that you're working, one thing you just said that jumped out to me is that you said different players, some players may suffer because they're not doing enough, and some players may suffer because they're doing too much. Now, I got to believe, being a 30-year position coach myself and coached a lot of different positions, that some of that is talking about maybe an offensive guard compared to the receiver in a spread offense. And some of it, though, you might be talking about Charlie Coyner as compared to Keith Grabowski, you know, what we do with them. And Keith may be the guy that's running the kid into the ground, and I might be the guy that's too soft on him throughout the season. Am I on something there?
Sure, exactly. I mean, for one, as far as running-wise, just talking about that and the condition, like a lineman doesn't need, obviously, what wide receivers going to need. So I know for guys in high school, it's kind of taking the team as a whole when you're looking at conditioning. So, like, for instance, if we were to do a shorter, like a 10-second run with guys, your lineman, the distance would be considerably less with skill positions. And then I think part of it to kind of make it so that it's enough for some guys and not too much for others is just keeping the intensity with it higher and the volume just really on the lower end of it. So that the guys that are getting too much, it's not adding even more to that or barely adding more to it. And then the guys that are way under, at least they're getting a small taste of it. I mean, that's kind of the whole challenge with all of it. I think at any level is that, you know, you have guys at different ends. I mean, probably how much, even in one game, offensive guys may be on the field twice as many plays one game versus the next game and vice versa with defense. So I think kind of getting a feel for that, like when they may need it more than not need it. But again, it's still the fatigue and doing too much oftentimes can be more detrimental than guys not being in shape, if that makes sense. So the practice has to be what it has to be. As far as plays and the individual, whatever the guys are doing in practice, I mean, that's kind of, by our standpoint, the coaches are doing kind of what they feel that they need to do at the time. So as far as any extra conditioning, usually we would try to err on the side of less is more. I mean, the majority, I think, especially in high school also, that toward the end, it's just the cumulative fatigue of the season also. So as far as having to do too much, I definitely say to err on the side of less. And then if you are doing anything, just kind of make sure that they taste some of that, you know, higher end of it versus, you know, doing a lot of aerobic conditioning where you're kind of wearing the guys out, especially as the season goes on. I mean, back in the off season and before the season starts is a little bit different story. But really, I think at any level, trying to battle the fatigue, whether it's muscles are fatigued and the guys may pull something or just fatigued and they can't, you know, perform to the level. A big part of battling the fatigue is kind of fueling the athletes, getting the right fuel in them. And I know that, you know, there's a big buzz for nutrition and, you know, healthy eating and stuff, but really, especially for football players, it's not really complicated at all. They just need, really, carbohydrates is a big thing. And the more you can get in guys, even in high school, I mean, the guys are younger and more resilient, but still, that's the fuel that they're running on. So the more you can get them with, you know, higher, not skipping meals and eating, make sure they're getting carbs, is going to push that fatigue a lot further down from when they're going to get tired versus guys that don't have any energy, aren't eating well.
In this next segment, former NFL coach Charlie Coyner joined us to talk to quarterback coach Wade Wilson about two-minute offense. Wade Wilson was the quarterback coach for the Dallas Cowboys and tutored Tony Romo through his playing career, as well as helped get Dak Prescott started. And in this next segment, he talks about the two-minute offense from the quarterback position.
In the NFL, it may be different. It is a lot different than the high school game from a standpoint of how intricate maybe it can be. But I also look at you from a standpoint of just working with a young quarterback and some of the things that go into a two-minute drill.
Well, because, yeah, I mean, for me, first and foremost, it has to be poise, composure, but with a sense of urgency. And what I tell, I've had Dak, I've had Romo, who was 2 years in the league, and then I've had Dak as a young guy. But stay within yourself. The common thread is what I've seen from young players. They try to do more than what's asked of them. And, you know, I'm supposed to run a 17-yard comeback, but corner wasn't there, so I broke to the post. That's not what everybody else knows. So just don't be more within your job and stay within the system.
Okay, and then as you look at that and you're preparing, let's say right now, and put yourself in this situation, you're a high school coach, you're a college coach, and you're sitting there and you're looking up and you've got the very beginning of the season and you've got a young quarterback and you're in your meetings. But how do you approach that, Wade, as far as you're going to talk about 2 minutes? When you start organizing your quarterback's brain around how you're going to do a two-minute drill, do you break that down, I mean, by – Are you looking at throws to the sideline in one area, looking at you've got timeouts where you have throws in the middle field? How do you organize that?
Well, everything is predicated on situation awareness, of course. How much time do you have? What's your objective, a field goal or a touchdown? How many timeouts do you have? So many things. What's the kicker's range? Things that gets talked about during the course of the week. And all those play a factor into, you know, making their decisions. I would say in this situation, this is what we like. If we don't have any timeouts, we're working high lows on the boundary. And understanding that time is more important than yards sometimes. So you got to be prudent with the football and communicate and play with poise.
Is there anything in a meeting, do you take the quarterback through video and show them a two-minute situation and let them manage it from the seat, or how do you do that?
Well, definitely. We actually practice our two-minute on Thursday, but we found it was better for us and for our defense if we practice against one another instead of carding that and blowing everything down and getting everybody lined up. So, you know, just play fast and apply your rules. But then on Saturday morning, we would have a report, a cut-up, the tendencies. Do we want to pick on a specific player? Best formations? Is it 3-by-1? Is it 2-by-2? Is it empty? All those things are given in. And then what's our best matchup? And we talk about we take plays out of the game plan and specific to 2 minutes. And these are the plays we're going to run. We want to be in 3-by-1. We want to run Witten on an option. Or we want to throw day to death or whatever that is. But it was very, very specific on what we wanted to do in 2 minutes.
Coach, when you look at today's high school offenses, today college offenses too, a lot of those guys are running an up-tempo offense throughout the game. And I've heard this argument from them that they don't put in a two-minute offense because they already have something like that. But I would contend there's a lot of things you need to address in those situations. Again, like you said, time being the most important factor rather than yards, that maybe need to be thought of outside of your normal up-tempo offense. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I totally agree with that. I mean, I think it's still the same formations, probably the same protections, and basically kind of the same offense. But players need to know what the situation is and what the rules are. I mean, the rules from each level is a little bit different. So just knowing that time is of the essence and you should pare that down. You have your offense that's run throughout the course of the game and some of those plays might carry over, but how you approach those plays might be different. Instead of trying to turn it up the field and gain five more yards other than getting out of bounds, be a situation like that.
When you think of practicing that, Coach, I know for me it would be something at the college level we'd work that on a Thursday, varied actually over the years what time in practice, but we were going to have a couple periods there where we worked the two-minute drill. And early in the season, I would always call that for the quarterback and get him to understand the thought process. But as we got going and we had those periods, I would really leave it up to him to go ahead and orchestrate the offense. Do you think that's effective as far as trying to get your guys settled into that kind of stuff? Because as you mentioned before, poise and composure has to be a big part of this as well.
I do think that's effective. And there again, I've been out of the game, college and high school game, for 37 years. But I mean, with all I know is what I know is the coordinator can talk directly to the quarterback. So that makes things so much easier. And the quarterback can do everything with hand signals and code words. So, I mean, it's very similar. But yeah, practice. And if you have a quarterback that you trust and y'all rehearse this stuff and you talk through this stuff, I think that that's fantastic for him to take charge of that, because our first, I guess, commandment in 2 minutes was believe. And to me, believe means you believe in your quarterback, you believe in your players. They know the situation. They're not panicked. They're not going to go crazy. And they know what it takes to win 2 minutes. And to me, if you have trust in that quarterback, then that's fantastic.
Former NFL GM and coach Michael Lombardi joined us to share his stories of coaching with iconic coaches like Bill Walsh, Bill Belichick, and Raiders owner Al Davis. He gave us incredible insight into the game. And in this next segment, he talks about how critical it is to have a good staff and what you should be looking for in building out a staff. He also talks about what it means to be a program guy and the importance of player development. Let's take a listen.
Well, I think there's six coaches that I talked about. Obviously, the head coach, the offensive and defensive coordinator, the two line coaches are critical, right? And then the special teams coach. So you take those six and you really put them. And you know, most defensive linemen are tough to handle, right? We all, the kids that play defensive line, are not always the Phi Beta Kappa guys. They're not always the self-motivated guys. They're always guys that are really talented that you got to get them to work hard. So you need a drill instructor there. You need somebody who's going to demand from them. You can't have them have somebody who's their best friend. And then the offensive line coach, he's got developed talent. I mean, he's got developed talent. Al Davis used to say this to me all the time. Make the coaches feel like they're high school coaches. Not disrespectful to high school coaches, but high school coaches, as you know, you can't call up your general manager and say, get me three new players in today, right? There's no new players coming into high school. Right. You got to coach who you have. You got to make better with what you have. That was his point. And it's the same thing in pro football. You got to make players better when you get them. That's the key. That's the secret sauce in New England. Dante Scarnecchi gets a guy. He's better for them than he is for anybody else. When they leave, they're not as good. And that's really the essence of a coaching job, is don't tell me what Walsh used to say. Don't tell me what the player can't do. Let's figure out what he can do and make him do that well.
And you have a section of the book, you talk about program guys, that I think the quote was from Coach Belichick, that we're not collecting talent, we're building a team. And I know, having been on the recruiting side of things in college ball, but also looking at, you know, the high school side of things, we always talk about program guys, and that's kind of almost like a negative. The kid doesn't have a ton of value, but he's good for the program. You guys are obviously looking for the right talent and for a guy who fits into the program as well. And there's been a lot made, and media talks about it all the time, guys who maybe aren't a great fit somewhere else yet somehow become very productive and successful within your program.
No doubt. I think sometimes that program term makes it apply that the player's, you know, an overachiever. And no, he's just a guy that puts the name on the front of the jersey is more important than the name on the back. What is mental toughness? As I define it in the book, Belichick talks about it all the time. Mental toughness is doing what's good for the team when it may not be good for you. And that's a program guy. That doesn't mean he's less talented. That just means he believes that the name on the front of the jersey is more important than the name on the back. And when guys start worried about the name on the back more than the name on the front, you don't have a program guy. You can't win. Your culture is going to erode very quickly. and you can't really manage that guy. You can't handle that guy. So that's what we were always looking for, guys that cared about football, guys that wanted the team to be successful. And then once you had those kind of guys that'll work hard, then you could start focusing on the points of the game, the non-obvious points, and make do.
The other thing that impacted me, I remember we used to have a period, and I must have got it from reading something about what you guys did. We called it opportunity time. I know you call, I think you called it opportunity period, or it was something built in your practice every day where you guys were developing the next players, those guys down the line.
Yeah, I think we were all about player development. We were all about trying to handle what we had to do and how we did that. And we needed more time to do it. So therefore, it was critical that we had those extra periods and the players got more coaching. And so what happened, it started in Cleveland. We would basically send in the first team coaching staff, the Kirk Ferenzes and all the other guys. And then we had the second team staff out there, stay out there and work that.
You mentioned in the book also, though, thinking about those guys, a lot of times they play scout team for us. And I can't remember the defensive lineman you talked about, but he was an incredible scout team player because the scout card removed the thinking, it removed the decision-making. When I think about our game today and what we're trying to do with our players, and I'm really equating this to the high school level, I guess the thing that really came to my mind as I was reading about that in your book was, you know, do we do our younger players a disservice of running everything off of scout cards? Is there a way we could do it better so that they do have to think and develop their decision-making and vision and all those things that are required when they're out there running real plays rather than ones drawn up on a card?
Yeah, once you allow a player to not have to react and play, you really aren't judging them. You have to understand there's certain periods as a coach that they're not evaluation periods. They're like, for example, 9-on-7. You put a 9-on-7 period together, and you'll see 15 coaches running down, scouts running down to the 9-on-7 to watch it, and they're taking notes and evaluating the players. 9-on-7 is not an evaluation period. It's a toughness period. You can evaluate their toughness, but when you know it's all run, you can't evaluate. Mm-hmm. Football is a game of run or pass. So when you've taken the game and made it all run, and the players know it's run, you can't evaluate them. That's not fair. You're going to misjudge the evaluation. So it's the same thing with card players. Guys that look really good with the card because the card tells them where to go. Like example for a receiver. Receiver knows where he's going because the card tells him, but then in the game, he's not sure what coverage he's reading. It becomes a problem.
Just about everybody knows Noel Mazzoni and what he's done at the college level with his end zone system, but he also spent 4 years as the wide receivers coach for the New York Jets. In this next segment, he talks about what he's seen from other big name coaches in putting together practices, as well as the popular concept of No Sweat Thursdays and Fast Fridays.
Yeah, and first of all, I'll preempt this with that nobody has cornered the market on the perfect practice schedule, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've gone and watched Steve Spurrier's practice, and I've gone and watched Nick Saban's practice and Bill Belichick's practice, and they're all very successful, and they're all very different, okay? It's all what they believe in, what their emphasis is, and what's important to them and what they believe to be successful and to win football games. So this isn't like, oh, man, if you practice this way, you're going to win every game type deal. It's kind of like, okay, everybody's a lot of different ways to skin this cat. And practices are very personal. You know, this is what I need to get done today. This is how I want to coach my guys. I'm going to push them hard, not push them hard, whatever. Okay, you guys, you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
There. All right. One of our philosophy, which we got back, which is kind of a Chip Kelly, who I obviously steal a lot of stuff from Chip. And this was I thought we got from him years ago, is about the Tuesday practice, Wednesday practice. It's all, everybody builds its own way. One's a red zone day, third down day, normal down, however you structure that. Okay. But then Thursday is kind of what we call No Sweat Thursday. So in other words, this is a day where basically we're trying to take the physical off our kids and it be basically mental day. And where we're going to line up and kind of go through all the drives. So I'll basically script drives all day. And it's basically kind of a run through. And just so we make sure our signals are right, make sure guys understand the calls, make sure they know their splits are right, whatever. Okay. And the defense will pretty much give them kind of the 80% rule on the defense. We're going to see 80% of the time guys against all these different looks. And it's a very low impact day for us. And so it's kind of like sharpening your sword. I just stole that from Mike Leach, by the way. It's kind of like sharpening your sword on that day, right? And then now Friday is what we call Fast Friday. And Chip's whole thing was, and which he did obviously tremendous study into this, was that your neurological system, you can't have your guys be still for 48 hours and expect them to go out and after the first kickoff be at full tilt. All right, so we need to like break a really good sweat 24 hours before kickoff. So we kind of want to rest them a little bit on Thursday, take it off their legs, low impact day, ton of mental stuff, go through all your situational. Then Friday, it is freaking balls to the wall now. We're rolling on Friday. It's Fast Friday. Everything we do is full speed. We're finishing. Now, we're not out there very long. Okay, 45 minutes to an hour maybe, all right? But when we hit the field, we are playing at game speed. So there's a couple things that we talk about, like every day, Tuesday and Wednesday is every day is game day. That's that mentality, all right? Friday is game day mentality, okay? Thursday is, hey, take a deep breath, okay? Now we're prepared for the game. Let's go practice this stuff full speed as quick as we can, and let's go play it. And I mean, we've been doing that for a while, and we do that even on Tuesday and Wednesday is what Coach Summon calls fast start. And we did it with Mora, and I think Chip does it where right after stretch, all right, he may blow the whistle and say, all right, ball's on the 10-yard line going in, let's go, and it's full speed. So it's kind of that same thinking is you're kind of setting the tempo. You're kind of setting the tempo for that practice right there. Might be four plays, but, man, we're going. And it's all one-word plays, and we're tempoed, and we're going fast. Well, that's kind of what Friday is. We're kind of setting the tempo for Saturday's game.
Former NFL quarterback Jake Plummer joined us on the podcast. After he starred at Arizona State, he went on to enjoy a decade-long career in the NFL, and he discussed accountability through preparation and how smart playbooks can be hugely beneficial to both players and coaches.
Well, you know, that's the thing. You're putting it on the players. Accountability is a huge thing when you get to sports. If kids are taking the time outside of their allotted hours, you know, in NCAA, you got a 20-hour work week. And even in the pros with the new CBA, you know, rookies at 2 p.m. in the offseason, once they're drafted to the team and they get to that team, at 2 p.m. they have to leave the facility. And, you know, the players negotiated this, which is great. You know, you can keep them away. You get them fresh. But some guys really want to make the team, and if you're not allowed to be there, taking home a big thick 4-inch playbook, it's great. But if you're not an impeccable note taker, if you don't have a memory like an elephant, you can't recall everything that coach told you about a play. You know, you're kind of going on your own memory and what you've heard from the coach, whereas with our product, we hope that there's the ability, like I said, to hear the coach give that same chalk talk again at 3 o'clock, maybe again at 8 o'clock that night. So you come in the next day and you've gone through what coach went through in one meeting. You've gone through it again two more times before that next practice. So we feel that will give these guys a huge advantage. We've had some great feedback so far of some kids that have used it and had great results coming from an air raid, learning a pro system. It helped them. It helped them tremendously. So that's our hopes is to make players more accountable, even though there are limited amount of time that you can spend as a player at the facilities or in the offices in college. Everybody that has dreams and aspirations to be, whether it be a starter at college or make it to the pros, you spend countless hours outside of that on your own. And so this is a tool that kids don't have to have a coach sitting there telling them they're right or wrong or marking red ink on their test. This is a way to test, and immediately you get the right answer if you're wrong shown to you. And that data goes straight to your coach also, so they can plan for practice and tailor make their individual sessions with their players to cover what they don't know. And anything that saves more time and makes you more efficient, a lot of people are interested in that.
Jake, one of the things right now, and some of it is blown up in the media, but obviously the safety of the game is a concern for a lot of people. I talk to coaches every day on the show, and everybody brings that topic up, that, you know, safety is a concern. How does something like this help in those regards? Obviously, it's nothing that's going to protect the brain directly, but how does having a system like this help players to get on the field and perform safer?
Well, I mean, everybody knows if you're playing at 100%, rarely do injuries occur. I mean, they will. In the game of football, you just don't know when it's going to happen. But I've seen countless times when guys were going, you know, maybe three quarters or not quite full speed. That's when usually when injuries occur. And what causes a player to not go full speed? That's not knowing what to do. It's having hesitation when the ball snapped, hesitation when you're running your route, if you don't recall the depth, or when am I expecting the ball? Am I the number one receiver? Am I primary? Or am I number two? Am I number three? What's the timing on this? You know, that all plays into safety and knowing, you know, what you're doing, where you're going, who your guy is you're supposed to hit and block or go after. I think that all leads to player safety. When you know what you're doing on the field, you should be in position. And when you're in position, you know, like I said, injuries can occur when you least expect them. But if you're in position, you're giving yourself, you know, a lot better, you know, odds against getting those injuries or getting hurt. But football, it's a rough sport. You know, safety in the game is a huge topic right now. They're doing a lot of things to, you know, fix the helmets and padding. But, you know, the more these guys lift, the faster they become. You know, it's two objects hitting each other, and most times someone's going to take the brunt of that. And I believe that, you know, with putting helmets on kids at a real young age is the wrong way to go about it. You know, but teaching them the game, teaching them positioning, teaching them, you know, the ins and outs of how players move and how an offense works or a defense works is key to preparing them to maybe not be 100% injury free, but at least put themselves in a better position to avoid injury.
Former Chicago Bear long snapper joined former NFL coach Charlie Coyner and I on the podcast to discuss the long snapping position, as well as some of the ins and outs of practicing the art of a long snap.
One thing that, as a special teams coach, once again, and obviously the rules always got in the way, but I always felt like, okay, your snaps look good. We're in the summer here, or the spring, or whatever. Your snaps look good, but you haven't put on a pads or and a helmet yet. I mean, to me, that's a different world. Obviously, the game takes it to a new level, but the looking between your legs and snapping with pads on and a helmet is different than doing it without.
So 100%. I got a couple stories here. One is Trey Junkin, the long time, I think 19-year NFL long snapper. We were playing in Arizona in a preseason game, and obviously it's 105 degrees out. And I was one that always snapped without my helmet in pregame because I'm a huge sweater. I just sweat like crazy. I didn't want to sweat on the ball. And I think this might have even been my rookie year. We're out there and I'm snapping pregame without my helmet on. And he was nice enough to come over and he mentioned, hey, man, you might want to think about keeping your helmet on and your, you know, helmet on when you're snapping. And I said, hey, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And I did just to do it for him. But I was one that I got into a routine where I always took it off just because I sweated so much. And I'm kind of going around in the story. But so what I'm getting at is that I do agree with that, Charlie. It is important to have your pads on and your helmet on, but I also think you can get a lot of good work without them on. One thing I would do is that during the off season, I guess it's maybe because I was an old offensive lineman and still practiced O-line, that anytime I could take my pads off, I wanted to. So I would practice without them quite a bit, but I would say 2 to 3 weeks before training camp or camp, I would always put them back on to get that feeling, because it is a different feeling. And then one great thing that happened later in my career is I started cutting down the chest plate of my pads. And I know now although there's long snapping pads out there, I believe, so that's cut down so it doesn't feel as different snapping with pads on as it does without pads. But to me, the biggest difference was snapping with a helmet on, because sometimes if you have maybe a longer face mask, you couldn't get your head down between your legs as much as you could before when you have that off. But I have my thing is, I tell kids, go with what, again, like I said about reps, what you feel comfortable. If you need it, keep it on. If you can snap just as well with practicing without them and then putting them on and you're fine, then go with that. But if you're not, then put that helmet and shoulder pads on.
We close out today's Best of NFL Coaches and Players podcast with one of my favorite stories, probably, that was told on this podcast since we started it. It's a story of how Michael Lombardi joined Bill Belichick and Nick Saban for dinner and what he learned from that experience. Let's listen in. One story, I guess, I really loved was your dinner. I think you said Bill's wife was out of town and he invited Nick Saban over and you got to be a part of that dinner that night. Just talk to us. I know you share it in the book, but talk to us a little bit about that experience and the, you know, what you're doing sitting with two of the greatest coaches in the game, just learning ball that night and it absorbing from what they're talking about.
Both of them are lifelong learners. I mean, I think that's the number one thing I could tell you from that dinner is they're both lifelong learners. Both of them weren't there to tell the other one how smart they were. Both of them were there to learn from one another. And that's critical, right? And so Nick's playing against all this read option and we haven't to the level, hasn't really hit. And Bill's picking his brain on how he wants to deal with it. Nick's picking his brain on how he's dealing with some other things. So it was truly a think tank. And that's what makes these two guys, from my time together with them in Cleveland, so unique. Because in Cleveland, when we were all together, Nick was a zero-pressure guy. Bill was a cover-two guy. And there was a meeting of the minds. And Nick has an adjustment to every call. Bill doesn't want to have a lot of adjustments. Bill wants the players to play fast and not have to think all the time. So you're talking about two guys from diametrically different backgrounds that come together because of their basic love of football and their lifelong learning is really what made this dinner so impactful. And it taught me that no matter how successful you are in life, you still have things to learn. And Belichick's taking notes. Nick's taking notes. Nick's serving dinner. And Belichick's writing stuff down. Nick's writing stuff down. It was really impactful as a young coach. You think you got it, you really don't. You need to keep going and keep learning.
There you have it, some insight from guys who have coached and played the game at an elite level. We wrap up our Best of series tomorrow with the Leadership Journey Season 3 highlights with Brian Kite. We will have a keynote speech from PJ Fleck from our national conference. And then we'll get into our deep dive on defense and all in on offense to kick off the 2020 schedule. If you're enjoying the podcast, please head over to iTunes and click a 5-star rate. If you have a minute, write a review. It really helps the podcast. Follow me on Twitter at Coach K Grabowski. Follow us on Twitter for our handle for football coaches at FBDEV Coach. And check out our systems for blocking, defeating blocks, and tackling at footballdevelopment.com.
Thanks for listening to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. For more resources, visit the Coach Performance Center at usafootball.com.